You're listening to The Science of Storytelling, presented by Pressboard, a show about marketing, media, and the people making it happen. Your host is Jared Grimm.
On today's Science of Storytelling episode, I'm chatting with Thaddeus Kromelis, Senior Vice President of Insider Studios at Insider Inc. We're going to discuss his winding career path to his current role at Insider, how he's possibly Canadian, and our shared fear of heights. If you like this episode, please leave us a comment and let me know what you think. Remember to subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so that you don't miss an episode. Please enjoy the show. Thaddeus, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to have you on here. So,
first off, welcome to New York.
Yeah, I'm from Vancouver. For any listeners that don't know, are you originally from New York?
I'm not originally from New York. I'm from Illinois, and I went to school in Iowa. However, and I don't mean to stereotype Canadians, so forgive me, I grew up following hockey, and then to this day I follow hockey, and my sons play hockey. So I feel as though, you know, being that I follow hockey, and I grew up on Kids in the Hall, that I'm partly Canadian.
You're like 80% Canadian.
And
that
I think
makes
so.
You 80% Canadian. Congrats.
Can I say fucking rights?
I think you can.
Yeah,
I think
there you can. Go.
What team did you follow?
I still follow the Blackhawks.
Oh, Blackhawks are a great team.
Yeah, hey.
I, unfortunately or fortunately right now, am a Edmonton Oilers fan. Grew up in Edmonton. So they were amazing in the 80s.
Yeah.
Wayne Gretzky.
Mm-hmm.
Edmonton is known for two things, Wayne Gretzky and West Edmonton Mall.
And burning first round picks.
And burning. Well, not yet. We don't know yet.
Yeah, true.
We don't know yet. It could be.
Connor's looking good.
It still could be a good year.
Okay, but I have a sense. You didn't fly to New York to talk hockey with a kid from the Midwest.
Mainly. That was the main purpose of it. Mm. But we could also touch a bit on your role at Insider. I think we may as well. Let's cover that for a little while.
Sure.
Okay. So tell me about your role at Insider.
So I head up Insider Studios, which is a team that has been around for now 8 years. It is a branded content team. However, in my tenure, we've also taken over all kind of pre-sale and post-sale. So we sit in service of a sales team, about 25 people. We handle all RFPs that come in for direct sales. That can be for display advertising, which is still a thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But more often than not, it's for custom content executions and editorial campaigns. And we are full service production. And so my team, you know, essentially, we have video producers to designers to creative directors to analytics to editors and so forth. And so we take good pride in producing everything that we do in-house.
Cool. And most people know Insider for one of your main properties, which is Business Insider. Did it start as Business Insider and then grow to have more properties, more, you know, segments that they're going after as far as content?
No, you're right. We are probably most known for Business Insider, and that is a property that is about 12 to 13 years old. Every now and then, you do run across people in this industry who say, oh, Business Insider, I love that magazine. I still get it to this day. In which you have to say, well, that's great. Appreciate it. But we've never had a magazine. It's always been digital and online. It started off as Silicon Alley Insider with Henry Blodgett, actually over on Park Avenue, not too far from where we are right now in New York City. But really the end goal of Insider as a vision is to really, you know, what we're looking to do is be like a media company for the next 100 years and really built for the digital generation. Now, yes, we did start with the business section, so to speak, but over time we've been building out all the other sections. Then now, so Insider itself, if you want to look at kind of what the editorial room looks like in and of itself, is we have, you know, Insider as the parent company. And within that newsroom, we have a news division, we have a lifestyle division, and we have a business division.
Mm. Great. And then Insider Studios works within that for whether you're distributing on any of the properties.
Absolutely.
Come through the Insider Studios.
Yes, absolutely. We sit in service of all of them.
Great. Now, I can't imagine that there was, you know, you growing up. So you grew up in?
Rockford, Illinois.
When you grew up in Rockford.
The home of?
Oh, what is it?
The home of Cheap Trick.
Oh, wow.
I know.
It's no Wayne Gretzky, but.
It's close.
Not bad.
No.
And so when you're growing up there, I imagine you and all your friends were thinking, I'd like to be the head of a branded content studio, that or a fireman, but probably one of those two.
Yeah, so we would be in a garage smoking pot, listening to Cheap Trick, and definitely talking about how we get our in this branded content game.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the truth of the matter is I went to Iowa, the University of Iowa, home of the Hawkeyes, but also home to a pretty well-renowned writing workshop, writing studio, studied English, studied writing. did a little bit of radio production, as we've discussed before. But then from there, what do you do with a liberal arts degree when you're in the middle of a sea of corn? Generally speaking, at least from my perspective, you run to one of the coasts. I chose New York because I didn't want to drive and be in LA. I like driving, but I don't want to be in LA. I like seasons too. And so, you know, I like snow.
Right.
Again, part Canadian. Well, do Canadians like snow?
Well, I'm in Vancouver. We can't really handle snow in Vancouver. It's a bit of an unknown thing. Is we had snow in Vancouver a couple of weeks ago, and I have two kids, and it was maybe 6 inches of snow that was melting fairly quickly, and all the schools were shut down.
Yeah, terrifying.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, so most Canadians can handle snow. Mm-hmm. Vancouver, not so much.
Right. So anyway, I have my liberal arts degree here with a focus on writing English in addition to, at the time, what was called mass comms, mass communications. And so that entailed everything from, you know, radio production to film production to, you name it, mass communications, you know. So moved out to New York City because it seemed like the land of opportunity in 2000 at the time, given the fact that, you know, what I wanted to pursue, whether that was writing, what may be. And in some way, I lucked into or kind of backed into a career in publishing, magazine publishing.
Right.
So I made my way out here and I got my first job at a Reed Elsevier company named, and I worked at a magazine publishing, I worked at a trade publication called Interior Design Magazine. Now I've already told you extensively about my interest in hockey, my Midwestern roots, it wasn't quite my main focus of interest, interior design. However, you know, over time, I did grow to enjoy, learn to love it, learn to really understand, kind of get a good grounding in architecture and so forth.
Was it that you wanted to get into publishing, and so this was a place that had a job for you in publishing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really it. And it was a small enough team that I was a jack of all trades. And so I got to do fact-checking, copy editing, maybe write a story, do, at the time, was photo research, so handling film, which is how things were published back then. And so got a really good grounding in terms of also kind of graphic design layout because, you know, we had production shops and all that kind of stuff. And so, but from there, my boss, the good old Mayor Russ, I have to make sure I give him a quick shout out. He is still at Condé Nast, as a matter of fact, as the West Coast editor of Arc Digest. But he got a job at House and Garden and brought me along with him. And so I backed into a career in publishing, and I definitely backed into a career at Condé Nast because, you know, I really was not Condé Nast material. I doubt they would have hired me out of the box had I moved out there.
Well, what would Condé Nast material be at that time?
I think probably someone who had a trust fund and was well put together enough and can also live, again, trust fund, could live on a salary of $18,000 a year in New York City and still show up in a Chanel suit with like a ruffled fringe.
Right. And that wasn't you?
No, it was not me at all. You know, being at House and Garden too was a very Tony magazine. And so we covered a lot of very Tony things, Tony classy, whatever you want to call it. And so here I was, always kind of a fish out of water to many degrees, showing up to the decorating and design building, working with decorators, going on photo shoots, you know, as a 22, 23-year-old boy from the Midwest. And, you know, for the listeners at home, I mean, I'm a 6'4", pretty kind of corn-fed boy from the Midwest and didn't always fit in there many times. And I believe we were discussing this beforehand, is it didn't happen that frequently, but on occasion at a party at a decorator's house, I won't name the decorator, but his house actually was two blocks away from here in the Flatiron District at the time. There were times in which I was mistaken for a male hustler at some of these events and parties, but...
Part compliment, part not compliment, considering
it's
you weren't.
Really backhanded, I think.
Yeah.
As far as that goes.
And that you didn't follow that career. You didn't decide that that would be your next move.
Whilst offered to me, my degree didn't really necessarily give me the skill set.
Yeah. Harder to explain to your parents.
Maybe. I don't know. Right. Really? Branded content versus hustling?
I
think
it's the same.
My mom would probably understand hustling better than branded content.
I don't know.
Or digital marketing or programmatic. Yeah.
Yeah. So. How would you explain your job to someone who isn't in advertising, marketing?
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe one of the friends you grew up with that maybe didn't go into this field of work.
All right. So at Insider, we have a massive audience. Brands want to reach that audience. We work with them to create the marketing that will most likely resonate with that audience and ideally achieve the objectives of that advertiser.
That's cool. That makes sense.
I hope so.
I tell my parents that and my friends and family that I did all the Old Spice ads.
Mm.
And the only reason is because I say I'm in advertising and they immediately ask me which commercials I made.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so I say, which is your favorite commercial? And they'll say, I like the Old Spice one. I'm like, I made that.
Yeah, like in the 80s.
I apologize to the people that made the Old Spice ads. Mm. But several of the Grimm family now think that I made it. So if we ever meet in person, I'll make sure to give you credit where credit is deserved. But I think it's easier than explaining, in my case, that I'm the founder of a tech company that supports branded content for media publishers. None of those words are regular words.
No, not at all. And I think we agreed to not discuss jargon while we were here today.
That whole sentence was
jargon. But look, let's get back to Condé Nast, right? Mm-hmm. So this was still not the golden era of Condé Nast. However, we did a fair amount of old school things, which I think ground you in some form of storytelling and diligence and carefulness about how you approach content and creating stories. And so, like I said, we still had, we were still printing magazines. We did photo shoots on 4x5 film. And so you had to be really diligent about making sure that when you're shooting things, they look good. And consequently, you had everything that you needed and so forth. It wasn't digital. You couldn't throw stuff away. I mean, it was a big deal when we got a 22-megabyte camera one day at Condé Nast because, we used that to shoot all of our product. But to that end, too, it really gives you an eye for, it's not digital. And so you need to be mindful of cutting words and having the appropriate layout for flow of information and all these things that, while not always applicable apples to apples in terms of how they transfer over to digital, at the very least, I think, ground you in proper storytelling, how to really kind of move people along. And I think so long as you have the fluidity and the mindfulness to understand that, like, a magazine is not a website, which is not a podcast, which is not a nada. If you can adjust and adapt accordingly, the fundamentals of storytelling can remain the same, in addition to have some great images, have some great copy that pulls people along, like all that kind of stuff. And so, right. So I was fortunate to work at House and Garden, and it's also there that I went on to meet Deborah Needleman, who brought me into found Domino. And so I got to work on the founding of a magazine at Condé Nast. I was probably the fourth or fifth hire there. And I can recall when it wasn't named, we were on a floor with no people, which was a little creepy in the middle of Times Square, and working from Word documents, really trying to figure out exactly kind of what this was. And so there I also learned a fair amount of, like, how do you lay out a rubric? Like, how do you make reoccurring stories? Like, all this kind of stuff that, I think, if you are fresh in your career and just kind of going into digital, whatever it may be, if you're joining us at Insider, I think a lot of folks, from what I gather, I don't know how much grounding they really get in that kind of thoughtfulness about how you set yourself up to create content day in and day out, week in and week out, in a way that's sustainable and is enough to really, here's some jargon, engage an audience.
Mm-hmm. Authentically.
Authentically.
Just to add that in.
Yeah, I was recently at Brand Storytelling out in Utah, Park City, for Sundance, and authentic storytelling from humans was also, you got to add the for humans part too.
It's good. It really, really finishes the sentence.
Yeah, and really, I think, checks all the jargon boxes you possibly can. So anyway, that's kind of how I came to be, I think, in terms of getting established in publishing, but then from there kind of took a little bit of a left turn, so to speak, into Blue State Digital, which is where I began to do a fair amount of wireframing, some bit of web development, and very conversion-focused kind of marketing specific to nonprofits, political campaigns, things of that nature. Blue State, I think you can guess where that's going.
I'm guessing.
You can guess. But while I was there, we were acquired by WPP. Our WPP acquired us. Sorry to use the passive voice there. And within that time, began to work more with the Grays, the Landors, the various other kind of large advertising firms of WPP. And that was great, and I think gave me good exposure to how Colgate markets, how Procter & Gamble markets, how other people do their marketing outside of just the nonprofit and kind of foundation work that we're doing at Blue State before we were purchased.
What's the biggest, P&G compared to a nonprofit? Mm-hmm. Those are two ends of the spectrum. Is there a big difference in the way that they market a small nonprofit compared to, one of the largest advertisers in the entire world?
They look for their main moments, I'll say that. And, wasn't expecting this question, but a lot of nonprofit work leads up to the fact that most people give donations at the end of the year. And so some of our clients were essentially kind of keeping the lights on in terms of marketing, but really saving up all their kind of dry powder or their marketing funds for the end of the year, where they could earn, no joke, 50% to 70% of their revenue for next year in the span of between Christmas and New Year's,
right?
Through donations. And so, you know, I think P&G somewhat aspires to a little bit of that kind of hands-on, always-on, friendly form of marketing in which they're always in your feed and top of mind, and in some way providing you content that tugs at the heartstrings and kind of moves you along. And so I think, you know, foundations and nonprofits do a very similar thing, but kind of specific to whatever the topic is they're trying to address.
Yeah, it's interesting. The limited resources means you're going to have to strike with your marketing at a point where it makes the most sense. Whereas if you're, you know, P&G and you're selling toothpaste and lotions, et cetera, that there aren't, you know, once a year moments that that's happening.
No.
And then, so you were at Condé and then you moved more into the agency world.
Mm-hmm.
And then how did you find your way over to Insider?
I had a stint at Edelman Digital, New York. And so really kind of learned the comm side of the house. So less the CMO and more the CCO. So different budgets, different marketing objectives. And so a lot of that was more kind of what you might call brand storytelling in kind of the lowercase sense. And so how do you spin up a narrative that's specific to the origin story of this brand? What does the brand stand for? So less selling a product and more selling a company or selling an executive or doing that type of work, which was great and interesting. I had some really good clients in terms of HP as well as ADP, and got me a good grounding in terms of B2B marketing as well. So did my stint at Edelman. Great people doing great work. However, was presented with an opportunity. Insider specifically reached out to me, and you know, they had the studios team, and they wanted to figure out ways to evolve it, bring it along, and ideally grow that in terms of a revenue stream. And so, you know, I felt, given my skill set, my abilities in terms of storytelling, my eye towards design, the range of clients that I worked with, it felt like a good fit for me specifically. And so from there, I began to work with Pete Spandy and others at the company to really kind of grow out what that offering is. And, you know, that process continues. And so, you know, to give you some like insight into the Insider's business, direct still remains a huge portion of it. But as we grow the company, direct will continue to grow in terms of kind of overall top line. But, you know, programmatic is obviously an increasing thing. And affiliate programs, subscriptions, like, you know, I think to the credit of leadership and we've always been a company that has many different revenue streams and fires in the or pokers in the fire. And so if programmatic has a bad month but we have a good month, all's fine. You know, if for whatever reason Facebook decides, hey, we don't like 30-second videos, stop doing those, we're fine. I mean, albeit we take a little hit, we figure out the next thing, we move on. But you know, that's been kind of the brilliance in terms of the model that we set up, in addition to some of the challenge as well, is that and some of the opportunity. And so I think to unpack that a little bit is, you know, I think in some of the discussions we had before this, you wanted to know, like, what is it about, like, Insider that's, like, interesting, or why do I stay there? Or, like, what is it about it that I find compelling? And
yeah, what's exciting about it?
I mean, not to give a sales pitch, but I mean, I think, like, the fact is, like, the newsroom in and of itself, and you know, talked about there's news, there's life, there is business, kind of all under one roof. Within that too, I mean, there are different types of reporters that we have there. I mean, there are people that are concentrating on kind of velocity and how far and wide and how much impact can their story have. There are people that are really tasked with going deep on specific topics and driving subscriptions and kind of going deep, whether it's on covering Goldman Sachs and kind of what they're up to, or is it, you know, Tesla and what they're up to. And so we do a fair amount of service journalism as well. And within that, a lot of it is distributed via, you know, SEO, via YouTube, via Facebook, via TikTok, via Slack, you know, you name it. And so all is to say, in one way or another, we have a newsroom that literally sits beneath us. They're on the 8th floor, we're on the 9th floor, and sits worldwide, as a matter of fact. But we have a newsroom that is constantly tinkering, innovating, trying to figure out, like, okay, so we want to reach these people over here. How do we do that? What is a story format that's going to resonate? So, you know, to give you a specific example is 2-3 years ago, we started Insider. I mean, it was really more so a way in which the newsroom was trying to figure out how they create social video and master that. And we're talking a room full of, you know, 7 interns, Nick Carlson, figuring that out. And they did figure it out. And to their credit, you know, we're able to amass a huge amount of views and develop a huge following, so much so that we began to, you know, we built and owned and operated around that property, and then brought it into the fold. And lo and behold, you know, we figured out how to do lifestyle content, but that all kind of sparked, and the moment came from really working on trying to figure out social video and what would resonate there. So with that in mind, you know, we now have salespeople, we have, you know, we have companies coming to us, like trying to figure out how to kind of unlock that and what's the potential there. And so here it is. I joined an organization 4.5 years ago known as Business Insider, very focused on B2B marketing. Next thing you know, we're trying to figure out how do we get Diet Coke and their new kind of can innovation, you know, out in front of as many people as possible, specifically on Facebook or on YouTube.
We'll be back to the episode in just a few seconds. But first, we have some exciting news for you. At Pressboard, we love stories, but we know how hard it can be to measure them. So we're here to help, whether it's a sponsored article on a news site, an Instagram post from an influencer, or a video on YouTube. Our tech measures it all. Pressboard is already trusted by Spotify, Intel, NBC Universal, Hearst, and thousands more. And here's the big news. Listeners of the podcast can try out the Pressboard platform for free. Just email info@pressboardmedia.com right now. All right, let's get back to the show.
I like the idea of learning from the editorial team's need to be able to get stories out there. And whatever way that, you know, if it's on TikTok. And then the studio, you know, can follow that lead. You don't have to reinvent it. You can use similar tactics, similar processes. I'm familiar with Business Insider, and I have been for years because I read a lot of business news, right? But I have come across a lot of travel content that comes from Insider. I imagine that's one of your core verticals. And it's interesting to me, one of the campaigns I'd like to chat with you about is the Travel Dares campaign. I think it's interesting. It's not one that first comes to mind. When I think of Business Insider, I'm thinking, oh yeah, they're probably working with the banks and investment firms and, you know, some SaaS companies that are selling software and stuff.
Yes.
But this is a little bit different. So can you walk us through the Travel Dares campaign and then and how it came about?
So Travel Dares is a great success story for the team in that this is basically will soon be a 3-year ongoing kind of engagement with the client over at Chase and as well as Marriott Bonvoy. They came to us and wanted to reach a younger audience, the one that you found in Insider, and I think you're correct in that travel was a key vertical that we were really, I guess, as some of the younger folks in the newsroom would say, crushing it. We were doing, you know, getting massive amount of reach and views there. So we work with them to basically spin up what we saw as like a 7-8 episode adventure, basically highlighting different places that you know, our two hosts would go. They were obviously places that Marriott had some footprint in, but we were there, and basically they were traveling. They were traveling to challenge each other to get outside their comfort zones. You know, we had two hosts. One might be particularly scared of heights or fast moving things, whatever it may be. Could be new foods, could be whatever. And so trying to figure out ways to illustrate the kind of the benefits of traveling in the Marriott family, in using the Marriott Bonvoy card, while also making it entertaining, fun, and something that you want to engage with. And you know, I think in many ways that campaign hit the mark many times through in terms of just the, you know, I forget, there's a gaudy amount of view time that we had there. There's so while views are great, view numbers can be huge, and you know, can reach up into the millions. I think we are most proud. I would say, of just the amount of view time we were able to drive. And so that means, like, true, you know, people are sticking around, people like the content, people come back for the content. We launched a season one, which then rolled into a season two, and people, you know, were right there to pick up again and had equal amount of success. So, I mean, I think we did a great job in getting it onto Facebook. We did a great job of getting it onto YouTube. We used all of that content to be distributed around our owned and operated sites, cut downs, things of that nature. Used it to make pre-roll. We also did on-site content. And I think, you know, over that time, we've moved from, because we were able to have such a great partnership with the client and such great trust there, we've moved from a place where at the beginning, in the first year, was really trying to just brand awareness. And then from there is season two, really getting to kind of more car benefit. And then season three, we're looking for ways of how do we then advance it to almost a full funnel activation. Are there ways that we can make it so we have the brand awareness, we have like the engagement, the benefits, and kind of the core parts of that mid funnel. How do we get it to also just potentially in an affiliate way or otherwise, how do we get to drive card conversion as well and new accounts? But again, it's been a long-running series for us. It's been great in terms of, I think it also was a proving ground for the team, whereas we move from a place of where, you know, quick Facebook videos, 30, 45, two-minute views or two-minute videos, to a place where now the episodes are, you know, that's those are done with like two shooters and two hosts and, you know, pretty kind of quick and well produced, but, you know, not necessarily like what we're at now, where it's like the team has evolved to basically be shooting TV quality shows in my mind. And, you know, we go shoot an episode in Wales and we have drone operators. We have, you know, three or four shooters. We have a fair amount of production planning that, you know, historically just wasn't necessarily part of the insider DNA or ethos, whereas now it's becoming more and more part of our ethos, and it's affected the storytelling that now a lot of our video team does on the edit side as well. So,
yeah, these aren't small programs. And you get, I watched a few episodes because you end up in a wormhole. Yeah. I watched one episode. I have a fear of heights, mm-hmm. so I like watching anything that has other people have a fear of heights. Makes me feel better about myself.
I do too. Do you get that weird feeling in your stomach where you feel like you're gonna, like fall over the edge or?
It's funny. So I've always had this has been my main fear. My dad owns a construction company, so I spent most of my youth two stories up in the air on a plank of wood, between two ladders, which made it worse.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. I had to paint houses in college and. It's a similar thing, being on a rooftop. And then also, I think I'm going to compound it a little bit here, whereas I was the only person on the crew who the general contractor didn't meet in Narcotics Anonymous. And I don't use narcotics. And so...
So you got all the really important jobs.
Yes, in addition to like having the guy holding the ladder might, you know, at some point drop over from a heart attack. Or whatever.
Right.
So it's great. But anyway, you were saying, I don't mean to...
I had this fear of heights. And so when I was watching these videos, I saw the one, there's that Via Torre, I think it's called.
Oh, that bridge. That's
terrifying. Across the south of France.
The hike up to the actual kind of base of that too was terrifying.
Well, and the scariest part was when you get off. I saw them get off the other side, mm-hmm. and they just have to go straight up a cliff face.
Yeah.
And this bridge is this single plank, and sure, you're tied on. Mm-hmm. But do you really want the experience of having to use that tie on, which means that you've fallen off of a bridge and you're hanging from a bridge?
No.
So I watched that episode, and then I watched the high-speed... I think that was the one in Wales, possibly.
Wales, yeah.
Yeah, and so I went down this wormhole of watching several of them, and what I realized was just the production, you know, resources that are required to travel around the world and shoot this content across mm-hmm. there. Now, when you're doing something big like that, I understand you can do that, and you're doing it a couple years in a row, but how does this high quality, high production value, high resource, how does this scale?
That's a great question. And it scales in so much as you need to have very different product offerings, I think. And so we look for a way to have a different product suite. I mean, I think it's similar to, I wouldn't say it's analogous one-to-one, but similar to how the newsroom approaches creating their content. They have people that are there for velocity to get a lot of impact that's going to go around the web. It's going to get millions of clicks, views, so forth. Then they also have people who are doing subscription work, and those stories take 1 week, 2 weeks, you know, could take 6 months to report and really get a good kind of thoughtful, insightful scoop on WeWork that other people wouldn't necessarily have. And so that drives subscriptions. And so not all of our work, if all we did were travel dares, we would have a huge production team. You're right. And so we also look for ways in which we can supplement that with simpler forms of content. And so we still do a fair amount of articles. We still do a fair amount of distribution for our clients. And so they may come to us with something, we'll repurpose it for them. So it's all about getting that kind of right amount of blend of content therein. And I think also one of the benefits too, though, of working with a partner over a long period of time, and this is what we experienced with Dell Technologies, they stuck with us or have been with us, I guess, for 3.5-4 years. Is that at a certain point you have a pretty large ecosystem of content that you can then start to test, prod, work with, and splice and dice and repurpose and move around your owned and operated, use in ad units, use to collect first-party data. And so you can make the content work over and over and over again because there's always going to be a new viewer. There's always going to be someone that's new too. And so, you know, I think it comes down to when you do make those really kind of high-end pieces of content, how do you then begin to repurpose it and use it in more thoughtful ways as well?
Yeah, I think we're seeing that now that branded content, I think of the life of branded content as an industry being the last 5 to 7 years is when,
yeah.
I mean, it's been around.
Unless you get back to David Ogilvy and his Guinness ads with the Oyster menu. Yeah.
And then there you go back.
There's that.
The furrow was John Deere back in like 18 something.
Oh, that's a Iowa shout out. Thank you.
Is it?
Oh, John Deere, please. Yeah.
Go John Deere. I had a John Deere tractor.
I would hope so.
Yeah. Who wouldn't? I was in Edmonton, Alberta. It's what you picture a Canadian farm boy. Yeah, so it's interesting to hear this idea of repurposing, because I've seen it over the last few years is that you create these great pieces and, you know, thousands of people see them, but they're evergreen in nature and people can still continue to see them into the future. So you can take something that was created maybe 2 years ago that doesn't have a timestamp on it mm-hmm. that makes it dated in any way and then bring it back to the forefront. And I've seen it quite a bit across there. And it's an interesting way. And I wonder if we'll continue to build this library over the next decade and be able to repurpose it, and the great pieces of branded content will continue to shine over time.
Yeah, I mean, to speak to that specifically, is YouTube is the gift that keeps on giving. And I'll say that Travel Dares, while the IO has been executed, we're done with that flight, and we're working on the next season. Seasons 2 and 1 continue to chalk up a huge amount of view time from an hours perspective on YouTube. It's remarkably so. I mean, we're talking like 10 to 20,000 hours, you know, of watch time a week, you know, at one point. And so this is when we weren't promoting it. We weren't doing anything. It just kind of gets into the algorithm. YouTube does its thing. Go forth and conquer. And I think, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was just listening to the Conan O'Brien podcast this morning. And he was talking about, like, with Keane Peele about how, like, their comedy, they tried to always make sure that everything was evergreen and not topical, because you know, in 5 years, how well is a joke about the Exxon Valdez going to, you know,
it's not gonna play.
No, it's not going to play. And so, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do for in those instances, I think, yeah, are very kind of evergreen. I mean, I think, but the clients we work with, I think by its nature, that kind of marketing is evergreen. I would say it's not often we do a lot of like Super Bowl specific ads or things like that. So.
Yeah. Well, that's great. What do you see as the future for Insider? Let's look forward 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm. The future of Insider is, I think, what we continue to push in terms of, you know, the web content is going to be more robust. I think we're going to, the life section will get, you know, far more kind of, I think, shape, and we'll continue to kind of develop that. And so look for us, again, in food, travel, but beauty and parenting. I think a lot of our editors are kind of coming of an age where they, you know, have kids now and they're looking for answers there, and they're approaching it from a different way than I would have approached parenting. And so they're looking to solve those types of things. And I think we'll develop a huge amount of readership there, which we already have a large amount, but it'll continue to grow and we'll find ways to work branded content in there. The newsroom is continuing to grow. We're opening up an office in Singapore. We're getting to a really kind of true and consistent 24-hour news cycle therein. So news will grow. Business Insider will continue to, I think, grow in terms of a subscription offering, as well as, you know, events and things that we do there. But where I see, I wonder where the opportunity may well lie is this could be a moment in time in terms of where branded content is at, or where some of these clients are. It could just be our clients. But, you know, we have people coming to us like asking, like, can you help us film a documentary? I'm like, well, you know, Insider, Business Insider, or, you know, Insider Life or Insider News, not necessarily known for documentaries, but, you know, we're happy to figure out how we could potentially do this, or what is the Insider version of a documentary, you know? You know, that may well just be 30-minute, you know, 60-minute episode, or so we'll figure that out, you know? And I think if anyone can tell you, though, what the media or publishing landscape is going to look like in 5 years, I mean, I wouldn't place a bet on it.
Right. I mean, I think we've got enough experience on placing bets on pivots, too.
Yes.
Certain things that haven't really worked out. So
yes.
I find this diversified business model is just smart. It's just you have some subscriber revenue, you have advertising revenue, branded content revenue, mm-hmm. possibly events and documentaries and things like that will fall under, you know, studio and production revenue
yes.
as well.
Yeah, no, we do work with the events team pretty closely and they tend to be integrated. And so there are some advertiser components and on-site components. So, I mean, that is definitely part of the offering, but how do we evolve that? And so it becomes continually something that's kind of more unique and more in our voice is what we look to do. And so the Ignition events have been a really good driver for us with a lot of clients.
Yeah. I'm super excited to see where Insider will go. I love this branching out. I'm excited to see how this kid from Illinois that's into hockey,
where he
will go.
My question for you is, I mean, what have you, you know, you talk to a lot of people. What are they saying is the future of publishing in 5 years? Are you hearing trends? Are you, like, what are you seeing?
Yeah, well, I think everyone has been really burnt by these pivots in the last few years.
Yeah.
I think everyone made some big bets and said, we're going to pivot to video.
Would you say VC-funded
bets? Yeah. Mm. Yeah, a lot of money requiring.
We're owned by Axel Springer, so we don't do huge VC-funded bets, which in many ways is, you know, we do smart growth, in my opinion.
And I think it's just a return to sanity. I think it's this idea that maybe media companies aren't meant to be invested in as tech companies are that may burn quickly and then flame out. I think it's about building credibility with an audience over a long period of time and learning and growing. And I believe that we're seeing the repercussions of these quick pivots. And a lot of people just followed someone else's lead. Someone took a bet. Everyone said, okay, well, that seems like the bet. Let's all do that.
Yeah. What's the teen version of this? Or what's the... What's the adult version of this? What's the business version of?
Yeah, and you know what? In every industry, you might get one or two that get out the other side, and maybe they sell to another company, but that leaves you with hundreds of companies that made that pivot and maybe aren't so fortunate, and then how are they going to run a business afterwards? So I do see a lot more diversification of these bets. So TikTok's a big thing. We'll place some time into it, but we're not going to bet the company on it. And so that's what I've seen quite a bit. I think it's very healthy for the industry.
Yeah. I mean, do you run across a lot of younger folks who want to get into digital publishing or publishing? I mean, where does it sit from your perspective?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of excitement around social. And because social has become a media of its own kind, I think there's less excitement around Facebook just because of the news attention. But I do see a lot of excitement around the idea of being in marketing, a lot of times from a creator perspective. So I have young nieces and nephews and their friends, and they'll talk a lot about the idea of being an influencer, but the way they speak about it is, I'm really into biking, and it feels like I could bike and be really into this and maybe also make a career out of it. And I think it's interesting. Whether they all will be able to or not is separate from the idea. I do like this idea of, I'm passionate about something. There might be an avenue for me to be able to earn some revenue off of this. Maybe I won't get rich, but I'll still be able to bike all the time.
Sure.
Yeah. So I do hear some excitement, but less excitement, maybe less, you know, when we were getting into it and I wanted to, you know, I say this often on the podcast, I wanted Angela Bauer's job off Who's the Boss. Very specific role that I wanted. I wanted to be the head of an advertising executive.
Yeah.
Right?
So with shoulder pants?
With the shoulder
pants.
You
wanted the shoulder
pants. I don't know if I wanted the same blazer, but a similar one. And so it was very defined to me the type of role that I wanted. And now I see people more just interested in the idea that they can run a business off of a passion.
Yeah. And I think that's where Insider, in many ways, has had a lot of success as well. Is I've seen Nick talk about this many times. He's our global editor-in-chief, specifically about you need to, as a new journalist here at Insider, find your passion and the audience will come with you, and find that audience, you know, and so, like, that's what your beat will eventually become. And so if you are extremely passionate about how healthcare companies are being disrupted by the likes of CVS or Amazon or Apple or so on and so forth, and you write about it and you write about it well, you're going to have an audience. If you're extremely passionate about cheese in other countries and want to explore that, there's likely an audience for you, and it's going to be, you know, elsewhere. It's not, you know, the two may not be on the same platform, but ultimately that's what, you know, Insider is kind of built around, is a lot of people finding passion, you know, albeit there's obviously focus, but, you know, within life, business and news. But I agree, you know, it's not necessarily an influencer model, but it is really kind of getting people focused on passions. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We'll
Absolutely.
Have to do another one.
Please.
Completely focused on hockey.
Sure, we can meet in Minnesota.
Yeah, perfect.
Halfway.
I think Minnesota has the second largest mall in the world. So just to bring the full loop around there, back to Edmonton.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, the brick, right?
Yeah.
I told you my kid plays hockey.
Right.
I know about the brick.
Well, thank you so much, Thaddeus, for being on the show.
Cheers. Take care.
Thank you so much for tuning into The Science of Storytelling. Don't forget to leave us a comment. We love hearing from you. We have a ton more episodes coming up this season with some absolutely amazing guests. So make sure to subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so that you don't miss a single one. See you next time.